Support for WBFO and What's Next comes from our members and from Health Foundation for Western and Central New York, where racial and socioeconomic health equity are prioritized. Learn more about building healthier neighborhoods at hfwcny.org.
From Buffalo, Toronto Public Media, this is What's Next, an hour dedicated to amplifying the voices of marginalized and underrepresented communities across Western New York and Southern Ontario.
We cannot erase, we cannot reform, we cannot make things better if we're uncomfortable having tough conversations,
Absolutely.
If we're uncomfortable
Absolutely.
Talking about race.
What's Next carries forward our mission to engage in meaningful conversations about race, equity, and the shared concerns that deeply affect Buffalo's East Side and beyond.
Don't stop. Make those families part of your life. Their lives are part of yours. Don't stop.
Together, we dive into the real issues, striving for understanding, connection, and change.
In the suburban area, everywhere, we must work and teach our children.
Good morning, and welcome to another episode of What's Next. I'm executive producer Charles Gilbert. Today, we explore the complex legacy of our 13th president, Millard Fillmore, with Megan Gorman, author of the book, All the President's Money. She'll be speaking with Jay after we first hear from returning guest Tom Albrick, president and CEO of Goodwill of Western New York. Tom discusses the Good Skills program launched in 2021, which provides short-term training in manufacturing and tech-able jobs. He and Jay also talk about the challenges of reaching underserved communities and the importance of intentional outreach and recruitment.
Today, we're going to talk about Western New York workforce. This is, we've talked with Tom Albrick before from the Goodwill of Western New York, the president and CEO. We're going to get into some new updates on some of the numbers here in Western New York and kind of outline what is the reality when it comes to our region. Obviously, there's lots of talk, and it's no surprise when we hear about the poverty that lives inside Western New York and is most certainly part of the reality here. But there are opportunities for change, and Goodwill of Western New York is most certainly among those who are working to try to do that. Tom, thanks for joining us again.
Yeah, thank you, Jay. Thanks for having us. We appreciate it.
So when we flash back to our conversation from about a year ago, I think it was, there's a lot that's changed, and you're very much a numbers-driven individual, but what flashes out to you? What would you say is the headline or headlines when it comes to the Western New York workforce over the last year?
Well, when you look at the last year, and we're actually releasing a research paper within the next week here, we looked back at pre-COVID and then post-COVID. What I would say what the headlines are, we're making headway in Western New York from where we were post-COVID, but we also have a headwind and a lot of struggles. We're making good headway with manufacturing jobs, but we still have a lot of our community that is just left out of opportunity, and we're trying to change that with programs like Good Skills Career Builder and with the Western New York Workforce Coalition.
Yeah, let's outline Good Skills again here. What that's all about, who's available, who potentially could be part of that, and maybe some of the challenges that you have of reaching the people that really could benefit from this opportunity.
Sure. So Good Skills was established in response to COVID-19. That's when we worked with the University of Buffalo Regional Institute to see what the needs of the community were post COVID-19. And what we did is with the university designed a program to provide short-term training with rapid skill development and getting people jobs where there were good paying careers. And that was, and still remains, manufacturing and tech-enabled jobs. The idea was that many people in our community are trapped in a cycle of underemployment. So people are working, but they're moving from one low-paying job to another. The idea was to get many of those individuals as possible into careers where they did not need a high school diploma, but we could get them on a career path with employers that had upward mobility and good benefits going forward. So the program launched in 2021. It's, as I said, very data-driven and industry-focused. We built the program with employers, and I think that's critically important that we stress that. If you don't have employers at the table, what are you building programs for? So we have employers at the table telling us what they need in students or graduates to be successful and be hired. The program is open to, for anybody over 18 years old that's eligible to work in the United States with a GED. And we teach things. We have an intensive four-week onboarding, teach things like cyber safety. We do CompTIA training, which is a computer training program, OSHA certification, forklift training, and other workforce readiness components. That all ends, and this is the big thing, it all ends with a work fair where hiring employers are working with us that have jobs. So right. The people coming have jobs and are ready to hire people from the program.
You know, we've been hearing nationally and locally, even with, obviously with you in our previous conversation, about the idea that there's an advanced manufacturing opportunity. And one of the biggest struggles for those companies is finding the qualified candidates, finding the people who are trained and ready to go. Your program is connecting people in that regard. You're a numbers guy. Talk about the numbers when it comes to salary numbers that we're talking about here, the potential for people who go through this program and get hooked up with these jobs.
Yeah, so the median starting salary in manufacturing jobs right now for entry-level jobs is around the mid-45,000 range, which is significant.
Absolutely.
The challenges and one of the things that we built into the Good Skills program were many people, especially in underserved communities, never have had access to these type of jobs. And it's not that they were locked out. It's more that people didn't know. So part of our program, we have 5 full-time people that just do outreach and recruitment in the community. So they're reaching out to people and showing people, this is what manufacturing looks like today. It doesn't have to be what you think, dirty, stinky, all those type
dangerous,
of things, dangerous,
yeah. Mm-hmm.
That people might think about manufacturing, or I need some type of high-level skill was the other people's thoughts. There's lots of opportunity to get into a manufacturer and get upskilled with the right manufacturers and find a career. So that $45,000 over years turns into $60,000, $70,000, $80,000 and more. And not only that, all of these companies have really, really good benefits too, which is important to people.
Interesting to hear about the recruitment element. Again, kind of a surprise, but as I talk with other organizations, they are also taken aback to a certain extent how difficult it is to get their message to the people who really need to hear the message. You have recruiters out there. Talk about what they go about doing, how they go about functioning in their job of recruiting and finding candidates for these programs.
Sure. So they're building relationships with influencers in communities. So they work with the Department of Labor. They also work with leaders in the community, perhaps with churches, other organizations, and are getting to the people and where the people are. I think that people get missed because we don't take the time to educate people and go to where people are. We just assume you throw an ad someplace and
right.
people are going to show up. It's not that simple. And getting directly out where individuals are, it is a huge part of the Good Skills program and what makes it really, really successful in whether it's Niagara County or it's Chautauqua County or it's Erie County. I don't believe that we would be that successful as we are today without the outreach and recruitment component of it. And we identified that when we looked with the university at best practices that other workforce programs were doing across the country when we did the early research. And that was one of the components. If we were going to give everybody in our community access or opportunity, that we had to reach out to all communities.
I'm also interested when it comes to this, the idea that you want this program, the goal is to self-fund it. We
yes.
know about Goodwill when it comes to the Goodwill stores. We see them around, of course. Another one opening up soon in Olean, as a matter of fact. But that's ambitious. It's an ambitious element. But you're still online to see that happen.
Yes, our goal was to 90% self-fund, fund 90% of all of our expenses for our organization through our stores, which would include the Good Skills program. We are on track to do that, amazingly enough. Our retail has tripled in
tripled.
Our stores. Yeah, we'll just have tripled it the end of this year from where we were in 2020. And that was without adding any new stores. So we did add a new warehouse, but this now, as we add new stores, we'll quickly get to that goal. So I think this is really fascinating and reflective of Western New York and the community we live in, that we're able to do that. Because we're not doing that, the community's doing that.
Right.
We're providing the stores, but we have donors that are gratefully giving us their free donations, which we're able to then market and sell to our customers and turn those donations into cash, which we can move back over to our workforce development programs. And I didn't mention all of our programs are free. There's no charge to any individual.
Well, just back to the stores for a second. You're more of a numbers guy than a conjecture guy. But I'm going to ask you, what do you attribute? Triple the sales. That's remarkable. What do you attribute that to?
So I attribute it to a couple different things. One is COVID really changed the landscape. So we're riding a wave of thrifting. Thrifting became really, really popular. Sustainability is very popular with the younger generation. I believe that my arrival back in 2020 aligned perfectly with that change. And then COVID really, really pushed people more towards thrifting. Sustainability is huge in our community and actually in the world today. People are thinking about that waste and where, instead of throwing something away, can I buy something used and reuse it? That said, I've got to give a lot of credit to an incredible retail team that has improved processes throughout the company, lots of training, lots of development, lots of best practices, and really running a really, really strong retail operation.
So it's more than just taking some stuff and putting on hangers and putting on shelves.
It's much more. And it's probably the I always say that's the most complicated, simple business there is.
Sure.
So you think about it, somebody donates something and we turn it, you know, we put it out. It's not that simple because we have to sort through it. So we have to, you know, sometimes there's garbage, sometimes there's things that won't sell. We have to price it. And who in the world knows a price of every item?
Right.
So it, in the end, I think of us as in the back house, we're almost like a manufacturing facility with a store locked on the front.
Right.
And ultimately, we're a logistics business. If we start moving around things inefficiently, it adds too much cost. So we really, really focus on being efficient and trying to keep the donations, getting them from the door where they come in to the sales floor as quickly as possible, and eliminating adding extra costs throughout the way.
On What's Next this morning, we're talking with Tom Ulbrich. Tom is the president and CEO of Goodwill of Western New York. This is What's Next on Buffalo Toronto Public Media, NPR. Again, not necessarily to get into conjecture, but I know it's your job to keep an eye on what's ahead. And what is ahead are cuts in Medicaid, cuts in SNAP. We're recording right now on October 31st. When this airs, things may have changed when it comes to SNAP, but there could be some tough weeks ahead here for a lot of folks, as a matter of fact. But you try to take a larger look of how this might impact the Western New York economy. I'm not totally sure if that's hitting home yet. What's possible?
I think what's possible could be devastating, but we've got a plan for that. And I think the community has a plan for that. If the cuts were to go in effect with Medicaid and SNAP, the data shows it could remove about $700 million from the Western New York economy, which is going to put tens of thousands of people in a rough spot. There's no question about that. That being said, I'm not an expert on economics, and I don't know where New York State may step in. Nonetheless, it's going to be painful. And there's also a work requirement for Medicaid going into effect, I believe, around the first year. What I do think, if there's any opportunity in here, there's an opportunity for organizations like Goodwill and other members of the Western New York Manufacturing and Tech Workforce Coalition to step up to the table and be prepared for, you know, potentially thousands of people that are going to have some type of work requirement. So ideally, we still have employers in these two areas of manufacturing and tech-enabled jobs with lots of jobs. Ideally, we get people on a career path that changes their trajectory and changes our community's trajectory. So the summary would be there's big pain potential, but I think there's opportunity that many of us can step in and try to help with this.
So don't fear the end, so to speak, right now. I guess that's part of your job and part of Goodwill's mission is to provide hope, and obviously that's the case. But on a rational level, you see that there could be enough opportunities to meet what could be a lot of people who have greater needs all of a sudden.
I do think there's a lot of opportunity. Are we going to be able to meet all those needs? Likely not, but I do believe that I do want to approach it from a point of not hopelessness, but that there is hope. And I can't control what's happening at the federal level, but we can be here and support things where it's possible with the programs that we have, and we will be there to support the community.
You're involved in a coalition of manufacturers here in Western New York, Manufacturing and Tech Workforce Coalition. I think you told me what, 70 people are in a room at the time?
At a meeting, I think you would easily see 70 people. This is an amazing thing in Western New York that other cities and other parts of the country are looking at what's happening in Western New York. So with this coalition, it's a coalition of tech individuals or organizations that have trained for tech and also trained for manufacturing. It's chaired by Stephen Tucker, which many people in our community know as a leader of Northland Workforce Development, but includes tech employers, Catholic Health, Independent Health, Ingram Micro, M&T Bank. It includes manufacturers like Moog and Cutco and Cummins. It also includes a bunch of training and providers like Goodwill. So Goodwill, JCC, Northland, of course, is involved, Trocare, UB is involved. And then there's other individuals that are what we call pipeline developers. Organizations like Tech Buffalo that are feeding in. We've got the workforce development boards attending, and there's schools that are involved and funders that are involved too. So Empire State Development is involved. Wilson Foundation is involved. New York Power Authority. So I'll stop there. It's amazing how many people are involved trying to work together to solve the challenges in our community. What often happens in workforce development, organizations fight over limited dollars. We started working together, many of us back in during COVID, when we were writing grants at the time in response to COVID to open and new programs to solve some of the challenges. We all stay together, then have added new people. And this is led by the UB Regional Institute, but largely led by the Center for Regional Strategies, which knits us all together and keeps us moving in the right direction. It's something West New York needs to hear more about and be really, really proud of, to see all these people coming together, solving problems together, making sure we're not stepping on each other, making sure we're not doing the same program somebody else is doing. So I'm very proud to be a member of the coalition. We are Goodwill is, and I'm hoping even through this that more people hear about the great work that Stephen's leading.
And to that, you're seeing direct connections, not just through your organization, but you're talking and you're hearing from the employers and other training forces. You're seeing a direct connection between that need in the employment sector coming up and meeting the need of people who are looking for opportunities.
Absolutely. And that's the whole premise. If you were to get this down in a nutshell, is I know if Stephen here, he would say, if we're building programs without employers at the table that have these jobs, we're not doing our job.
Right.
So yeah, it's exactly what's happening is employers are involved, giving feedback, and we're iterating our programs to meet their needs. So an example would be, we got some feedback from some of the manufacturing employers to Goodwill to say, some of your graduates, they need better math skills. So we added a shop math, which is basic math that you would use in a shop. Some of the other employers said we would love them to have some basic skills to be able to read blueprints. So we're adding that in 2026. So that's the response the employers needs. if workforce providers are creating programs that just have a piece of paper or certificate at the end, that's pretty meaningless workforce development. All the programs that we're working on have jobs at the end.
Mm.
And that I think is the difference and really critical.
And when it comes to jobs, you were also sharing with us before we went on the air about some of the changes that we're seeing also here in the landscape, changes in jobs that are available, some increasing, some maybe slipping a little bit, and also maybe seeing some parts of our local community that are also finding maybe the numbers are increasing in terms of connecting with jobs. Why don't you share with us what you have?
Sure. I think this paper that everyone will get to see next week, or what the sort of headline is, you asked me before about right. headlines. It's really about how much our workforce has permanently shifted post COVID-19. So one of the things that I find very interesting, we still have many people unemployed. Our unemployment has actually increased by 17% since 2019. Excuse me. And we have a lot of people underemployed in our community. So over 86,000 people are underemployed, meaning simply the way we define that is that their income is less than 200% of the national poverty level, which for a family of four is around $32,000. So that would be lower than $64,000. There's some great news in manufacturing. That area, good skilled type jobs that we're training for, they're up 27%, the number of postings that are out there since 2019. Great news. So those jobs are rising. Salaries in those jobs are rising. We talked a little bit earlier about mid $45,000 right. for the median entry salary. And the community, some early data is showing that we are making progress on diversity of our workforce.
Great news.
Fantastic news. I can't say there's causation from the programs that have been running, but let's hope that we're beginning to make some headway. So just to give you a couple numbers, in manufacturing, people of color in the workforce, pre-COVID-19, were 15%. Post-COVID, or just recently when we did this data, 19%. So 4% more representation.
Right.
In tech jobs, pre-COVID were 16%. The latest available data is 18%. So again, making headway. Is it huge numbers to shout off the rooftop? No, but it's significant headway. And I think we should be proud of it. And we should continue to pay attention to these numbers. All that said, an area that is changing a little bit is in the tech and the tech-enabled jobs. They're actually, the postings are down in the community for those
right.
jobs. Salaries have gone up and are good, but the postings are actually down. Not sure why. I'm going to speculate a
sure.
little bit. I don't like to conjecture, but I will speculate a little bit. I'm curious if it could be the beginning of AI starting to impact some of these entry level jobs. Perhaps that would be call center jobs might be an entry level job for somebody in a tech enabled job.
Sure.
Because often you'll start there. You'll get additional training. You might go on into help desk and work your way up. So I don't know that. That's just a guess for me.
But there is no doubt that AI is going to impact the job sector. We could probably do lots of shows on that, and maybe that's something we'll do. Now, as I hear our producer Charles Gilbert is over there listening, but to that though, it does show that there's no doubt. I mean, it's conjecture. It may not be, but AI is a reality that is something that's going to be part of the workforce landscape.
And I don't think that AI is in itself perhaps going to keep somebody out of the job market.
Right.
Because I believe what's going to happen are people that know how to use the tools are going to have jobs.
Right.
People that don't. So again, back to goodwill and good skills and iterating, we are in 2026 going to add a very basic but entry-level AI class as part of the training in our tech program, just so people have some general information about AI safety and certain tools that they might be able to use. So as they're going in the workplace, they have a little bit of understanding. And it will be a very small understanding, but at least introducing people to how AI may impact their jobs in the future, or how they may use the tools in the workplace.
Yeah, because I mean, there is no doubt that on one side of the coin, it's got this whole ominous type of sci-fi future ahead. But, you know, on a basic level, using it day in and day out in certain capabilities, you know, it's not necessarily all that daunting or all that much different than some things that are going on right now. We're down to our final couple of minutes. And I know you wanted to come here. Well, first, let's make sure we do this. Let's connect. Let's make sure we connect. Somebody who's listening to this right now wants to find out more about Good Skills. What do they do?
Yeah, the best way is you can reach us online if you just search goodwillwny.org, and everything is right there for you. You just click on a button or give us a call. The number's right there.
And the Good Skills program, again, is free of charge.
Free of charge. Anybody that has a GED 18 years or older that's eligible to work in the United States, we would love to have you. We absolutely love to. We're running. We start new cohorts about every six to eight weeks. We launch a new cohort. We are covering Niagara County. We have a big presence in Erie County, and we have a presence in Chautauqua and Cattaraugus County also. So very trying to cover most of the Western York area.
And then I guess finally, again, you're just kind of sifting through this report that you're going to make available here. Asking a little bit of a prospect here of sorts, but what do you think? What is next, would you say, for this kind of, we can generalize it as connecting the workforce and giving the workforce what they need to what employers need?
When I read the paper and I sit here and I think about the work that we do, the work that we've done, the work that our partners do in the coalition, all the job opportunities, I really still continue to believe that much of the challenge is about access and showing people, giving people hope and showing them there are opportunities. If you're underemployed and sort of in this cycle of underemployment, that there's lots of help out there. Another thing I didn't mention, many of these programs, our program, Northland, we have 3 years of wraparound services. So people that are underemployed often are underemployed because of barriers like transportation, childcare, healthcare, a bunch of different things. We work with over 200 social services providers in the communities we work in to connect you with that. We give you interview prep training. So our career coaches will stay with you for 3 years. That's true of other organizations too, but I think that's the amount of time that people need that are perhaps chronically underemployed to really get that, you know, not a hand up, but a little bit of help. Because I always tell our team, we don't help anyone. Individuals help themselves. We provide the opportunity or the vessel. And I just think there's great, great opportunity. And as we together get more people employed, it not only helps the individuals, it helps our economy. Right. Every one of these good skills jobs at entry level means about $55,000 of immediate direct economic impact. When people are making more money, people are coming off of social services, people are paying taxes, that all lifts the entire Western New York community, not just today, but for generations.
Well, Tom Ulbrich, thanks very much for coming in, providing the update. Always great to have these lively conversations. I love kicking around the numbers with you, and you always come more than prepared. So we most certainly appreciate Tom Ulbrich. Thanks for being with us on What's Next.
Thank you so much. Thanks for having Goodwill.
There's more of What's Next coming up after this brief message.
From the fringes of the mainstream to the local music you love, listen to Buffalo Toronto Public Media at the Bridge Monday through Thursday, 8 p.m. to midnight on BTPM NPR at 88.7 or from your smart speaker.
You're listening to What's Next, our place to discuss the important issues of our communities of Western New York and Southern Ontario. We want to hear from you. Click on the Talk to Us option in the BTPM Listen app, and we will work to get your questions or comments on the air. Do you have a story or concern that we should be addressing? Email us using whatsnext@btpm.org. Together, we'll have the conversations that are needed. This is Buffalo Toronto Public Media, NPR.
Now, Megan Gorman, author of All the President's Men, joins Jay Moran to discuss her motivation for writing the book, Fillmore's background, political career, and the complexity of his legacy.
On What's Next today, we're going to be talking about the 13th President of the United States, Buffalo's own Millard Fillmore. Here to talk about it, Megan Gorman. Megan is the author of All the President's Money. Megan, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me on. I don't think there's many podcasts in this country where we talk about Millard Fillmore, so this will be fun.
You know, I just looked up. I wanted to see if I could find who the most irrelevant president was. And I think once upon a time, I think I heard Millard Fillmore had that distinction. But I think as history continues to unfold here, we're learning more and more. And that is one of the reasons why we really wanted to talk to you is just that. It's a complicated legacy that Millard Fillmore has, the Fugitive Slave Act being right there at the top of it. And well, I want to get into that for sure, but maybe just from your perspective, because obviously your book talks about all the presidents or most of the presidents. What about Fillmore as you were learning about him? Just kind of curious about how things unlayered for you, so to speak.
Yeah, I never thought in writing my book, which is about the personal finances of our presidents, that Millard Fillmore would be someone I would get to have a lot of insight into, right? You think Lincoln, you think FDR, but Fillmore? But, you know, it's interesting because one of the things that the presidents tell us when you look at their personal finances is they're really talking to us about the state of the American dream. And they also, at the same time, through their money, tell us about who they were personally. And so what I find so fascinating about Fillmore's story is that if I just gave you the basic facts, you know, grew up one of our poorest presidents, right? Makes his way to the big city to learn to practice law, right? Makes his way up the political ladder in that city and finds himself on the way to the White House. You would easily say to me, Megan, that's Abraham Lincoln, right? But that's Millard Fillmore's story. And what I think is so interesting about that story is that when you look at all of the presidents and you take the first six, you know, from Washington, Adams, Jefferson, Madison, Monroe, Quincy Adams, what those six had in common is they all had money.
Right.
They were wealthy. They were landowners. And then we get to Jackson. And Jackson starts the story of a poor boy going off into the world, achieving great success. And that happens again and again and again over a lot of American history, from Jackson to Lincoln to Fillmore, you know, to LBJ, to Bill Clinton, to Barack Obama, right? That is the story. And so we believe in this story of the American dream. And I think when we take that story and apply it to today, the question I would ask is, could a Millard Fillmore exist today? Could his story happen today? And if not, what does that tell us about the state of the American dream? So we'll get into that. But I think the thing with Fillmore is he tells us a lot about how hard it is to make it. And then once you have wealth or have money, what can you do with it to create legacy? And that's something that a lot of people focus on when they have money.
Let's just go back about Fillmore. His story is somewhat familiar, but at the same time, can you put it into terms that we'd understand today? Because we're talking over 200 years ago, basically, how poor he really was when he started out.
He was incredibly poor. So Fillmore is born about a month after George Washington dies in January of 1800. And he's born to a farming family. They have a struggle in one of their original farms with the title of the farm. They have to go and be tenant farmers. And all the historians that study Fillmore will tell you it was an incredibly poor childhood. And his father, you know, during the 1812 War of 1812, convinces his son, who's a young teenager, not to go be a soldier, but to go and work as a work in the mill to learn to be a cloth maker. And this is not uncommon at the time period. People would often become apprentices, learn a skill, and then of course become a cloth maker. And he goes to work in this mill house, and it's not a great situation. It's very bad working conditions. And at the same time, Fillmore is a curious person. And he has had a very, very basic education in a schoolhouse, but he knows how to read. And, you know, when he has time away from the mill, he does read. He actually gets a little bit of money and he becomes a reader in what's called a circulating library, which were very popular in the 1800s because people couldn't afford to buy books, but they could afford to be part of a group of people who would buy popular books. And so he makes his way. The mill work doesn't work out. He ends up, his parents end up convincing somebody, a wealthy landlord in town, to take him on as a law clerk. And he starts to learn the law. And that he ends up having a falling out with the gentleman who is teaching him the law, because Fillmore ends up taking on a case and unaided wins it. And he doesn't get a penny of the fees. So he sort of decides, I'm going to go off. And he hits this important age in the 1800s. He hits age 21, 22. 21 is a key age in the United States, because at that point, your parents can't take any of the money you make. And so he goes off first, to a little town outside of Buffalo, but then makes his way to Buffalo and is learning to practice law. And Buffalo at this time period is in this major period of transition. It's being rebuilt after the War of 1812, and he gets caught up in it. He becomes a lawyer, and he becomes part of the social community in Buffalo. And so much so that he ends up joining a church, the Unitarian Church in Buffalo, and is one of their founding members. So he goes rather quickly from being this boy who grows up incredibly poor, poor farming family. They first think he's going to be a cloth maker. He becomes a lawyer, and now he's part of society. And he marries this woman who's actually a teacher. She actually taught him for a bit, Abigail Powers. And they start to climb in the American dream in Buffalo. And of course, his, over his career, he's a lawyer, he's a controller, and then he gets into national politics, and he's Zachary Taylor's vice president. And lucky for Millard Fillmore, Zachary Taylor has the cherries and cold milk on July 4th, 1850, and dies 5 days later. And Fillmore is not a great president. He makes a lot of mistakes. One of the mistakes he makes right out of the gate is right when Zachary Taylor dies, he basically terminates the entire cabinet because the cabinet hadn't been nice to him. He's the only president who's done that. But he's not very good as president. And the big debate is, of course, the debate of slavery, the spread of slavery into the Western states. And even though he's not pro-slavery, he ends up signing the Compromise of 1850, the Fugitive Slave Act. And this is sort of a stain on his reputation. And before he signs the Fugitive Slave Act, his wife tells him, do not do this. You will never, ever have, you know, the status that you once had. People will be angry. And she's right. Now, he doesn't win a second term. He goes back to Buffalo. And when he gets back to Buffalo, his wife dies right before he gets back. And he was going to practice law, but then he thought that wasn't a really fair type of thing for him to be practicing law and somebody to be up against the former president of the United States. And so he decides to live off of his investments initially. And Fillmore had been successful as a lawyer. You know, when we have in the documentation of Fillmore's life, we have two times where we know his net worth. One is when he's alive and one is when he passes. But in 1847, before he leaves for Washington and becomes vice president, his net worth is $30,000. Doesn't sound like a lot, but that's about $1.1 million in our dollars today. So he had become pretty successful. The other number we know on his net worth is really when his son dies and his son's estate is valued about $280,000, or about $10 million in our money. So Fillmore goes back to Buffalo, and this is where he becomes interesting about his money. And the reason I say that is, in Buffalo, it was upsetting that he signed the Fugitive Slave Act. They were part of the Underground Railroad. They were not pro-slavery. And people shunned him. People in the church shunned him about this. But he goes on and he marries a wealthy widow, and he proceeds to get involved in every major civic charity in Buffalo. And so what's really fascinating about him is he really is sort of this one-man progressive movement, right? He's focused on making sure that Buffalo has these great institutions, just like Boston, just like Philadelphia, just like New York. And this is where he takes his money, and he's really able to try to, and I talk about this in my book, redeem himself.
You see that, though, as that it was an intentional effort to redeem himself? Did he have regrets about the Fugitive Slave Act?
So here's some of the challenges we have with some of the presidents like Millard Fillmore. Before FDR, you know, unless somebody took it upon themselves to save their papers, and the early founders saved their papers, from Hoover on, we had a lot of the papers saved, but there's a patch of presidents in the 1800s who didn't save their papers, and their papers are scattered. So what we know about Millard Fillmore is from his letters that remain. And one of his correspondents that he became quite close with was Dorothea Dix, the great reformer. And so he did express to her the frustrations he had being a post president, what he was trying to do. And then what we can see is in all of the Buffalo newspapers, what we find is that he focuses on putting infrastructure in place for a lot of the Buffalo institutions. So a good example of this is, you know, basically, he felt strongly about the mistreatment of animals. And he was one of the founders of the Society for the Prevention of Cruelty to Animals in Buffalo. And I believe was their vice president for a while. So you see it more in his actions. And you see it because he also appears a lot in public in Buffalo for these organizations. And so as part of my background and my job, I work with wealthy individuals. And so when you see people who are charitable, you're very focused on some of the technical aspects of it. And when you're looking at charity, the technical aspects of it are donor intent, deductions, right? Everybody wants a tax deduction, and impact. Impact, what are you really trying to achieve? And when I was studying the presidents, different presidents stood out for meeting these things, right? Richard Nixon wanted the deduction. And there's a big famous story about him. I talk about in the book, FDR and Warm Springs and the power of impact. But what's interesting with someone like Millard Fillmore is his charity work had a very big emphasis on intent. And the intent was to make Buffalo a great city with institutions that people could be proud of. And I think it was a bit of a thank you for all that he had gotten from being in Buffalo, from coming there as a poor boy to being able to build his career.
We're talking with Megan Gorman, author of All the President's Money. And our focus is on the 13th president of the United States, Buffalo's Millard Fillmore and his complicated legacy. Megan, I most certainly can understand the lack of documentation and about his intent when it came politically. Yet, an amazing story from a very poor man to becoming the president of the United States. That's very interesting. But I'm just kind of curious, as you look at this, though, Is Millard Fillmore, was he somebody who learned how to trade, that political insider trading to get what he wanted and was willing to trade off different elements? And I mean, I'll keep bringing up the Fugitive Slave Act because obviously it's a huge part of his legacy. So I guess that's the question. If you have a thought on that, I mean, was he in essence trading, you know, A for B, you know, whatever he got in return for signing and making the Fugitive Slave Act a reality?
Yeah, I mean, so I'll be the first to tell you, I am not the leading expert on Millard Fillmore. I know his money, and that's what I spent my time focusing on. But I think one of the challenges with Millard Fillmore is I don't think he was a strong politician, right? He didn't have the background. And when you look at some of the things that he did in the jobs leading up to becoming president, he was the controller. He was a money person. He understood the balancing of checkbooks, how to run money for cities. But he wasn't a politician in the sense of like an Abraham Lincoln. And so where I saw the stories diverge between people like a Lincoln and a Fillmore is Lincoln spent so much time developing political skills. We see Lincoln on the circuit as an attorney, and he's learning stories, he's debating. Millard Fillmore didn't have a lot of that in his background. His background was his legal work and then doing civic work. So I think when he got to the point where he was the president, and remember, he was an accidental president, right, because he was a vice president, he didn't have the skill set and the political savvy. And I think that story I tell where he fires Zachary Taylor's cabinet as soon as Taylor dies is a good example of that. It was short-sighted because he got rid of people who might have been able to help him navigate. And look, you know, one of the things that all the presidents talk about is that when they get in the job, right, it takes 2 years to actually understand how to master it, right? And he was president from 1850 to 1853. So he wasn't in the job long time before he had to make very, very difficult decisions. So I think that, you know, I think the decisions he made, you could argue he regretted. But then again, during the time of the Civil War, he was not pro-Emancipation Proclamation at all. He continued to sort of always be on the wrong side of history. And so what we have to do is, you know, people are not black and white, right? They're very nuanced. Even in today's day and age where we don't, you know, we don't like our politicians, we tend to miss the nuance of humanity in them. And that's the thing with Fillmore. He made a lot of bad political choices. He was not a great leader in the way that we want a leader to be. But I do think he was not all wrong and not all bad. I think that when it came to things that he felt he was good at, he actually thrived. And I think for him with Buffalo, I would tell you that he grew up such an insecure boy. He grew up with that poverty. He was always known to be, you know, sort of unsure of himself. But I think where he gained confidence was in building up infrastructure and civic organizations in Buffalo. Making big political decisions was not his wheelhouse. And so I do think he's rightfully judged as one of our worst presidents.
What about the money? You mentioned, of course, we talked about it at the start, how poor he was. He becomes fairly wealthy for his time. You quoted the numbers earlier. From where did he get his money? Where did he earn that wealth?
Yeah, so he made it himself. And this is the interesting part, right? Like, I look at this juxtaposed against today and the challenges it is today to build wealth. And, you know, he became a lawyer. He became a successful lawyer. And he was able to work his way up to take advantage of that. But he also, you know, ended up taking jobs within the city that helped build wealth. And he was able to buy real estate. He was able to save. You know, this was not a day and age like today where even people who have successful incomes struggle paycheck to paycheck. And I think that that's a really interesting thing. I think it goes to some of our struggles today as a country and why people, regardless of what political party they are, why they're so angry, is it's always been hard to achieve the American dream. Millard Fillmore worked very hard to achieve that dream, but it was possible. What I don't know is today, if we had a poor boy starting out and making his way to Buffalo to become a lawyer, could he be that successful financially? And that's where it's difficult. That's where I think you see that tension and that struggle. And so stories like Fillmore tell us that something has changed in how the country functions on a personal finance basis.
I don't want to put words in your mouth, but I'm just going to because it did pop in my mind since you brought us back a couple of times to this idea about the American dream, the reality for Fillmore and Lincoln and some of the other presidents you mentioned earlier on who came from nothing and became the most powerful person in the country. We want to inspire people, our youth, to think that they can be anything. But is that just not the reality today?
I think that the challenge we have today is a couple things, right? I think that we've become a system where we tell everybody in this country they need to go to college. And we're starting to have the right discussions of maybe it isn't the right fit for everybody. But you know, when we look at the course of the U.S., right, in the time that Fillmore was, making his way up, you didn't have to go to college to succeed. George Washington didn't. Abraham Lincoln didn't. Harry Truman is our last non-college educated president. And Truman was a very smart man, very self-educated. So I think what we need to do is take lessons from the past. And some of the lessons that you see with the presidents, which is you have to make a choice about education. And maybe going and getting an expensive education isn't the right one today. That there's this ability, maybe it's not self-education like they did then, but how can you be savvy about it, right? And there's this idea that, you know, pre 10, 20 years ago, when those of us applied to college, we applied to college with this idea that we would get a degree and our salaries would be better as a college graduate. But now in the day and age of student loans and high tuition, we need to shift our mindset, which is how can I get an education as cost effective as possible so I can get out there and start building net worth? And to build net worth, you can't have hundreds of thousands of dollars of student loan debt. And these are sort of the societal shifts that we have to happen. Other things that have to happen, and I saw it over the course of history with the presidents, is we have rules in place and things like buying a house that were put in place in the 1950s that are irrelevant today. Does anyone know why they put 20% down to buy a house? It's from a rule from the 50s. Hmm. And so you think about these hurdles. There's always been hurdles over the course of history. You know, Millard Fillmore building his own house. He does build his own house over the course of his life. That was hard to do, but it wasn't this hurdle that was insurmountable. And so I think that in this time of, I don't think it's unfair to say we live in a time of turmoil.
Right.
But turmoil can also break things open, regardless of your political party, to make you rethink. And I think that we need to rethink and restructure how do we get to the American dream? And should we make these requirements on buying a house so difficult, getting access to education so difficult, getting childcare so hard? We need to have these constructive discussions. And I think it's something the founders would have wanted us to do. Because when you look at presidents like Abraham Lincoln, Millard Fillmore, you know, Harry Truman, Dwight Eisenhower, all Gerry Ford, all who grew up really poor, they all had a mix of smarts, hardworking, and luck. And that luck element has to happen where there are things in society that allow you to grab the rung above you and pull yourself up. And that is so hard today. And so I think it's understandable why people are angry, because it's impossible to do the Millard Fillmore story. It's impossible to do the Lincoln story today. And so we need to rework it.
I appreciate that perspective for sure. And as we wrap up our conversation here with Megan Gorman, the author of All the President's Money. So final question about Millard Fillmore. We'll put aside the Fugitive Slave Act for this. We've already talked in a certain amount of length, the understanding of it. But what about his story and what he did post-presidency with his money? How do you fit that in the pantheon then, I guess, of other presidents that you've studied in terms of what they've done? Where does he fit in that?
In terms of his post-presidential career?
Yeah.
You know, I think that he's a model for a lot of what our modern presidents do. So, you know, when presidents leave office, it's a hard, until Gerry Ford, it was very difficult to know what to do. You could die like Washington, right? You could try to go back to practice law, but it was really difficult. Or you could write a book. Right. We have a lot of presidents that wrote books. So I think this engagement in civic life, in the charitable organizations of Buffalo, I think that was something that continues to be built on today. You see it with our current presidents who are, and we just lost Jimmy Carter, but he's a great example of it, civic engagement. And you've seen that with the Bushes. You've seen that with the Clintons, the Obamas, and obviously it's been pretty recent for the Bidens and Trump is back in the White House. But I think that idea of being engaged with the community is something that is a lot of the presidents have embraced since Millard Fillmore. And it's good to see. We want them to help build out the organizations that are near and dear to us.
And then just one final question just flashed to me. But what drove you to write this book?
I've always loved the presidents. Mm. And I'm sitting here in Cape May, New Jersey today, my hometown, although I live in California. And when I was growing up in the 70s and 80s, this was a very small town. And I loved the idea of these these stories of these boys who grew up in small towns, some poor, most of them poor, and that they were able to go on this hero's journey and find their way out into the world and achieve the presidency. And there's something very magical about that. And I love that in American history. We're in a tough period of time politically, but when you talk to Americans about their history, about the presidents of the past, and that amazing story that we have of the past 250 years, there's something that's so special and unique about it. And I love that. And that's sort of what drew me to this, coupled with the fact that I work in the wealth world and I see how people make money today. I could tell you about my clients, but it's far more interesting to tell you how the president did it.
I don't know. Maybe your clients are pretty interesting, too, but we'll have to save that for the next time.
Exactly.
Megan Gorman, the book is All the President's Money. We really appreciate you giving us some time today on What's Next.
Thanks for having me on.
That will do it for this episode of What's Next. We'll be back Wednesday with LeGarrette King to discuss his 8th annual Teaching Black History Conference, which took place over the summer. This has been What's Next from Buffalo, Toronto Public Media, NPR.
Support for WBFO and What's Next comes from our members and from Health Foundation for Western and Central New York, where racial and socioeconomic health equity are prioritized. Learn more about building healthier neighborhoods at hfwcny.org.